Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Transgression. It's me, Quentin, and this week we're talking about one of my favorite topics, which is battery optimization. Now, every single time we do an episode with an optimizer, we get tons of feedback that people really like the episode and loads of downloads. And this one will not disappoint. We're talking to David Miller from Gridmatic in the US. Now, Gridmatic's approach to optimization, they're big in the US, they've got a gigawatt under management, mainly in ERCOT and California, but their approach to the optimization business problem is quite different. So I think you're gonna really enjoy this. We go deep on AI and their $50 million fund and loads of other stuff. And David is a really deep thinker on optimization. So as ever, if you like this episode, please hit like, subscribe, and hit all those good buttons. It does increase our reach and means we can do more awesome stuff for more people. All right, let's jump in. Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So firstly, if you're listening to this and you haven't come across Gridmatic and seen some of their content and some of the awesome stuff they put out, then you need to go to their website right now and do that. I just want to firstly, as a person who believes greatly and respects good content, I just want to take my hat off to you and the team for what you guys put out there.
That's very kind. We feel the same about you all.
Oh, that was a good start. Let's, for our audience, if you haven't heard of Gridmatic, David, can you just take us through what Gridmatic does? And then we're going to talk about the title of this episode is rather grand. It's called AI in Power, which could mean lots of different things to different people. So we're going to talk all about AI and how AI can change market access and market participation. But first, what is Gridmatic and what do you guys do?
Sure. We were founded by an ex-Google engineer, and he saw the need for AI for the grid of the future and understood that wholesale power markets were really the foundation of that grid of the future. So he began by developing algorithms to trade in the wholesale markets, ISOs, and he modeled the grid using AI models at the nodal level and had success trading. And so now those same algorithms from trading are used for optimizing battery storage on the grid as well as load resources on the grid. And we continue to do that financial trading, meaning trading not backed by physical assets on the grid across all the US ISOs. And as a power marketer, we sell power to end users, retail electricity. And then we hedge that power by contracting for supply with batteries, with renewables, lock the powers, and then we optimize energy storage for ourselves and for others.
And so lots of people know about Gridmatic from an energy storage perspective. How does energy storage fit into the business and how much of what you do is battery related?
There's really three parts of our business, at least in terms of how businesses are traditionally organized in our area. So we're doing trading, we're doing battery storage and retail. So in that sense, you could say it's a third, although our view is that these pieces are all intertwined and will function as one business over time.
I feel like we should talk about two news articles from Gridmatic recently. The first one is fund related. You guys had an announcement around that. We can talk about that. And the other one is you surpassed a gigawatt hour of assets under management. Are those operational assets and where are they?
Yeah, so we have storage assets in both ERCOT and CAISO, operational as well as contracted in that metric. And those are projects that our battery storage fund that you mentioned has worked with as an off-taker or service provider. And so we're signing tolls as well as revenue floors for these batteries that we're then managing on the behalf of the owners.
And so what's the big vision for Gridmatic? Where are you guys headed? What does Gridmatic look like in 2030?
Right. Our view is that as electricity prices really become lower on average, but more volatile with the increase in renewables, that there's a need for a new type of load serving entity. And that's really kind of power marketing business that we're interested in. And so for us, the key thing is using battery storage and dispatchable resources to balance a load portfolio and serve customers with low cost power.
And would you class Gridmatic as an optimizer? Is that a word that you use for your business?
It is. Yeah, that's a part of our business because we really focus on battery storage optimization, both for ourselves and for our customers. And so when we're doing that, we do it across different models. And one of those models is a very traditional service model where we work as an optimizer on behalf of our customers.
So let's talk about AI for a few minutes then, because AI is a big part of what Gridmatic does. I've been struck by how much time Gridmatic spends talking to the market about AI forecasting. And so it must be really important to you, and I'd love to go down that rabbit hole. So could we start from the start? How does AI fit in an optimizer? And then why specifically the forecasting problem is that a good one to solve? And then how do you turn that into more dollars or more ROI for customers?
Yeah, absolutely. I would start with really the foundational activity in power marketing, which is forecasting electricity prices and understanding how to participate in power markets. Traditionally, that's been done through physics-based models of the grid. These are powerful models that take into account things like all the generators and the lines and the fuel prices and efficiencies, and they try to estimate what prices will be on the grid based on all those things, how the grid operates. And that approach works well if you're the grid operator and you have all that perfect information, but for everyone else, it's quite tricky, because these models need to be finely tuned and they require a lot of human oversight and ongoing tuning. And if you don't have access to all the data, it's hard to get them to produce accurate results. And AI takes a totally different approach. Instead of trying to actually replicate what the grid is doing, it learns from data and just infers how the system behaves. And what we've seen is that just as AI has outperformed traditional methods in areas like voice recognition or playing board games or generating images, it turns out that your AI can really do a better job of forecasting electricity prices as well. And because AI keeps learning and updating, it can really automate a lot of that decision-making, which has a big benefit for folks in the market. And so tying that back to the battery storage, you're running a battery, it's not just about buy low, sell high each day. It's really these ongoing, complex, probabilistic decisions that you have to do all the time to maximize revenue. And a person running a traditional forecasting model, it just can't keep track of all of these variables in one head. And so this is really kind of the exact type of problem that AI is built for, which is why I think that as storage markets evolve, the AI-driven forecasting optimization will become the market standard for operating on batteries.
And what's the input data? What's the training data?
Yeah, there's a lot of data. Our CEO, who I mentioned, comes from Google. He sometimes says, obviously, Google has tons of information. They index the whole web. But for the problem that we're looking at, we have just much more data than would ever be accessible to someone like Google, because it's very specific but voluminous data that we need. And it really revolves around weather and then also the grid and what the grid looks like. And so, on the weather side, we're very interested in AI-based weather models and understanding, how to get earlier and eat earlier in terms of just forecasting weather. And then on the grid side, it's really like, how do you take in the information of the grid and the representation of the grid in a way that is accurate, but also interpretable by an AI model? And we're constantly kind of looking at how we're going to do that. The methods matter as well as the data too. So just to give an example, one question we might ask ourselves is, how do we understand the impact on the grid of a big weather event? If a storm is going to come, maybe it's going to produce a bunch of wind and the wind power on the grid will be producing at all-time highs. Or maybe it's going to ice the turbines and take them offline entirely. And those divergent outcomes could be just a matter of a few degrees of what the storm is going to look like. And maybe they're happening at the same time in different parts of the grid. And so how you represent that appropriately in an AI model is really an evolving field of research.
And how many people are there at Gridmatic solving this problem?
We just passed 50.
50. And how many of those are engineers?
Well, it's roughly, I would estimate something like 35. The engineering team breaks down into a few different groups, folks focusing more on AI models and optimization and kind of software infrastructure, data science. But most of the company is based in the engineering groups.
I have to ask you a broader question, which is, in my job, I've had the privilege of seeing lots of different power markets and got to see the UK go from pretty much zero to where it is now, which is 6-7 gigs online. And one of the debates over the last 5 to 10 years in the UK, and that is now being ported to lots of other markets, of course, ERCOT and California have surpassed the UK in size now. But one of the debates that's just continues to go on is about whether humans are best at making decisions, or whether it's humans in the loop guided by technology, or whether we're moving to a world where it's fully automated. And Gridmatic's one of those companies that has really planted a flag on automation, right? And are you so operationally, do you have humans in the loop, or is this really truly automated?
There are humans, but we try to keep them in the loop as infrequently as possible. The big risk factor in an AI-based model is, what if something is going to happen that the model has never seen before and has no way to predict? And in the history of Gridmatic, we've seen that multiple times. In 2020, we had Hurricane Laura, which islanded part of MISO. There was 2021 Winter Storm Uri, which was in multiple ISOs, but especially ERCOT. There's been wildfires in CAISO. There's been others as well. And all these events impacted the grid in ways that didn't have exact historical parallels. And we were active in the market for these events, and they're very hard. And through these events, which we had, both successes and failures, we've developed a risk management framework where effectively we're asking ourselves the question, is there anything coming up that we have never seen before? So the model can't, we can't accurately trust what the model is seeing or what it thinks it's seeing. And if there is, that's when a manual intervention happens. And that manual intervention is pretty blunt, and it's really dialing back the risk level significantly. But then once the kind of maximum uncertainty passes, we go back to that fully automated approach right away, and the models are able to learn and recalibrate really quickly, faster than any human. And these interventions, they're quite rare. They happen, less than once a year in a market. And our history is that more often than not, the model would have done better without the intervention.
No way.
So even though we're trying to do it as infrequently as possible, we still should be doing it less frequently. But we have to keep that lever in place to really manage these tail risk scenarios.
So to build that, are you putting in guardrails for known unknowns? Well, this is a very complex problem, right? Because you have the known unknowns or the unknown unknowns. And of course, it's ultimately impossible to size the unknown unknowns. But the tricky thing is that, especially in the markets where you have a big presence in ERCOT and California, historically, the periods of the unknowns, known or unknown, are where there's been a lot of money on the table. So it's interesting that you say that the system or the AI model would historically have made more in those periods as well. But interested to how you build the system and define those guardrails and when the human steps in.
Yeah, at some level, it comes down to risk management, both human intervention as well as quantitative risk management. So the models are constantly running, and they are flagging alerts if there's something that looks unusual. Sometimes it's mundane, right? A data feed goes down. That's kind of a very common thing. And so sometimes you have to intervene for something that just, something is broken. But in terms of these, sort of extreme events, they're infrequent, but they do kind of require a human to look and say, okay, do we think that the model can accurately capture, the risk of what's going on here? Our CEO sometimes says, commodity markets have these structural dynamics where it's not hard to be right and make money a lot of the time. What's really hard is having risk management in place to not be really wrong at any particular time. And so that's just a big part of what we focus on the quantitative risk management, is we do look at metrics. We look a lot at different tail risks and risk metrics that focus on the tails to understand, is there anything that this model, is not seeing properly? So an example could be, we're seeing, let's say we're in California and it's, the hottest day we've ever seen. And the model doesn't really see any expectation of the price cap being hit. Well, something's wrong there, right? Like, why is there, maybe it's not the base case, but why is there not a scenario where that's happening? That would be a trigger where we'd say, okay, let's go in and look and see. We need to investigate further. And while we investigate, we need to pause what's happening to understand, why the potential range of outcomes that we would expect to happen here is not being shown.
Let's talk commercials a second, because you're a commercial guy. Gridmatic's offering is a little bit different to a traditional optimizer, if you like, right? So you do the revenue share, market access, control the battery. And of course, your angle on that is AI related, amongst other things in customer service and all of that. But from speaking to the team and seeing what you guys are doing in the market, it's very technology focused. But I was really struck to see that you launched a fund, $50 million, right? To underwrite floors. And you also offer a full toll. So you do everything from the bid optimization, the data and instructions, to revenue share, to full toll. I think that's quite interesting. How do you manage those three different contract types and different types of customers? And if I may ask a tricky question, which is, how do you prioritize those three types of customers in the system?
Sure. I mean, for us, it really depends on what works best for the owner and their capital stack. And sometimes these different contract structures will work best for the same owner because they're looking to mix and match their level of merchant appetite across their portfolio of projects. Right now in ERCOT, we're seeing a lot of interest in fixed price offtake and tolling or floors, but that changes over time. And we want to be available in the market depending on the needs of the owners. The way we think about serving all these customers is that we think in any of these relationships, you really need strong incentive alignment. We don't think the model works really well where it's a typical SaaS model and the battery owner kind of pays a fixed monthly amount to an optimizer or a software provider. The range in outcomes and optimization are just so wide that the owner needs a strong optimizer, and whether that's us or someone else, the optimizers will want to be paid based on their performance. And so I think the owner should want that too. Incentive alignment really helps for building relationships, but that's key for us. So in our service contracts, we try to structure it such that we're really only getting paid if we're performing well. And the same thing happens in the offtake contracts where we only make money if we're outperforming the floor or the toll. That structure keeps us highly incentivized to work on all these projects. And then on the technical side, you can segregate the activities such that no one model is getting more prioritization or more eyeballs than the others. They don't know what the others are doing, so they're each on equal footing.
Yeah, that was my next question. You must get this all the time. But if you're selling a service which provides the instructions, the price, the scheduling and the pricing for bids, as well as the full control, market access, optimization, to the point where you actually have skin in the game, right? Because you're offering full toll and revenue floors. How do you as a business prevent prioritizing the second lot there?
The real answer is on the technical side, there's just a wall between the models. And so if we operate two batteries that are owned by two different counterparties, each one doesn't know what the other battery is doing any more than it knows what all the other market participants are doing from disclosure data after the fact. So there's no sharing of information across those. And that's really, I think, the fundamental key to prevent any kind of either unfair activities or market power abuses. We also do things that are maybe more for optics. So like on our trading side, we won't trade on any locations where a battery storage exists. Even though that model doesn't know what the battery is doing, we just don't want to even, raise any eyebrows because it's there's plenty of nodes to trade on and it's not worth any kind of controversy.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because even if you have to play it so careful, the impartiality, because even if you're doing everything right, that the perception becomes a reality, doesn't it? So it's awesome to hear that you have those kind of rules in place. Okay, so you've got a gigawatt portfolio, something like that, right? Of grid scale batteries. What's the proportion of them that are taking bid optimization as a service and a scheduler versus revenue sharing versus a full toll? I know you can't share commercial data, but I'm just wondering what's the percentage split between in your business between those things?
There is a mix. We're seeing it vary a bit by market. In general, in ERCOT, there's much more interest in offtake because there's no forward capacity market. Owners that have a lot of ERCOT exposure are really have a strong desire to have some level of contracted revenue. In CAISO, there is interest in offtake for folks that are looking to kind of combine an energy and ancillary service offtake with an RA contract. But because the RA contracts already exist and provide a large portion of the contracted revenue for the project, there's a little bit less of a pain point. As a result, we're seeing in that market, a lot of the owners are looking more towards service contracts, and that's our portfolio reflects that.
Coming back to your approach, your AI first approach, my intuition is that you have traders who can trade the market and control assets. Then you have an AI solution that can do it. And they're operating batteries in a similar way, but one of them makes more money, right? This is the big fight. But does AI take, or your solution, does it take different types of decisions to what a human generally would? Or does it mimic human? Does it behave like a really great... I guess my question is, does an AI system behave like a really awesome human trader? Or does it behave like something completely different? A bit like, I don't know, you must have seen the DeepMind documentary about the Go, right? And the fact that move, you know, that move in that documentary that totally blew the socks off the entire Go community. Does an AI optimizer do anything really cool like that?
Sometimes, yeah. It really depends on what's happening in the market. There are certain days where it's not so surprising what's going to happen. And so the AI is, whatever, participating in the ancillary service or selling the energy at the peak hour, sort of similar to what a manual operator will do. But there are other days where there are weird things that happen, particularly when there's big divergent spreads between the day ahead and the real-time market. And so sometimes we see strange things like, oh, the power prices were high in this hour, but we sold reg down and had to charge during them. Like, why did we do that? Well, actually, it was just selling reg down because it was trying to manage its state of charge for, you know, optimizing some other ancillary service that were coming later. That makes sense after you think about it for a little while. So we have these cases where you have to, as someone who has some trading acumen, could look at it and have to think, okay, why is it doing that? And you really have to investigate, okay, what was the forecasting? What were all the different components? And it is hard for that to all stay in one person's head. And so I think in those cases, we do think things that are a little different than what a typical manual trader would do.
You're operational in ERCOT and CAISO right now. Interesting that you said that ERCOT, the market's more interested in offtake and tolls. I thought that was really interesting. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how that's changing? And is this a cycle? Does risk appetite shift back and forth in your experience? I'd imagine it does.
Yeah, I think a big portion of it is reactive to recent price levels in the market. We're an ERCOT Modo subscriber, and we pay close attention to the Modo Best Index in ERCOT, which shows the revenue performance. And you know, we love the service you guys provide, and we use it for additional analysis internally. And I think that, you know, the headline for 2024 that mostly gets picked up is that storage revenue in ERCOT was down relative to previous years. And I think that's to the point about offtake and service models. I think that's impacted a lot of the desire for revenue certainty, kind of this balance between fear and greed. But for us, there was another factor that really jumped out, and that was that there was a really wide range of revenue performance across the fleet in the market. We looked at the batteries that were just operating for the full calendar year of 2024, and we saw that among those, I mean, there were batteries that made on average $8 per kilowatt month, and batteries that made less than 80 cents a kilowatt month. I mean, it just got us really interested to dive deeper into what's driving the differences. So, you know, we saw a lot of contributing factors, but we saw the biggest factors were battery location, meaning siting, and battery optimization, so the optimizer quality. So I think as operators are struggling between those two things, some of them, as a result, are looking for offtake to kind of de-risk a portion of their activities.
Let's talk about location for a minute. Location matters so much in the markets you operate in. And no doubt you spent a lot of time thinking about this. So what can you share with our audience about location of batteries? And how should we think about location?
Clearly, you know, developers know that it's really those volatile nodes that are interesting for storage. But our data looking at 2024 shows some complicated results. We wanted to look at the Texas market and isolate locational value, ignoring other factors. And so what we did is we created a top-bottom or TB baseline for each of the existing battery nodes in Texas. So for example, for a 2-hour battery, we create a TB2 baseline, which just looks at, you know, what if you sell energy at the top 2 priced hours and buy it at the 2 bottom priced hours. To simplify, baseline is kind of what a typical battery should be able to achieve. It's not a perfect metric. You have to normalize it for battery duration. It has other limitations, like it requires perk foresight, ignores efficiency and other revenue streams. But we think that focusing on kind of this TB metric or as a baseline using energy spreads is a good baseline, because now most of the revenue for batteries in ERCOT is coming from energy. And so we looked at these TB2 and TB1 values for all of the batteries in ERCOT and found interesting results. The top TB2 opportunity for an existing battery in ERCOT was this volatile node in South Zone in 2024 that had a TB2 baseline of $10 a kilowatt month. And the lowest TB2 value was a low volatile node in the north zone that had a revenue of $4 a kilowatt month. And so the opportunity of just picking the best node versus picking the worst node in Texas was like roughly a 2.5x increase in revenue, at least from the opportunity of the baseline, which is, you know, a pretty big number in terms of the range of possible revenue outcomes. Another interesting note was that the relative value changed over time quite a bit. We looked back over history, and in 2022, if we're looking at the different zones, it was really Houston and West that were tied for the top kind of volatility values measured by this TB2 baseline. But in 2023 and 2024, it really changed, where West stayed as the highest volatile node with the most opportunity for battery revenue. But Houston actually had the lowest TB2 value, lower than the South and North zones. And it had a big negative impact on batteries located in Houston in 2024. So the takeaway for us was that this backward-looking volatility analysis isn't that useful. You really need unique insights about what future congestion is going to look like to be good at siting batteries, which is a very challenging problem.
Hypothetically, a developer comes to you, David, and says, all right, which nodes are hot? Apart from doing a fundamentals model, we could talk about that maybe another time, which of course at Modo, we spend a lot of time thinking about that. What's your approach? What's the framework of thinking about where nodes would be hot nodes? What are the things that you think about or look at?
Well, we do have to think about kind of what's the time frame for which the question is being asked. So if it's, you know, what's the next 10 years of asset life or for a toll contract, that's one thing. If it's, you know, really kind of where should we focus our efforts on existing portfolio the next year, it's quite a different thing. And for us, you know, we look at a variety of different model types. I think for the short term, we're strong believers in these AI focused models. And even in the medium term, I think there's big applications. As you go further and further out, you really do have to rely on fundamentals models to model the big changes that are going to occur on the grid. And so it's a big research area for us of just kind of understanding how to build the best in breed fundamentals models that kind of include some of the large data sets that we use for the short-term models. So we do that, we model that for ourselves.
Well, I guess you especially, right? Because if you've got this $50 million fund that you're underwriting long-term toll agreements or floor price agreements or whatever we want to call it, then you've really got to have a view on the future if you're going to underwrite these. Not only do you have to optimize them, but you really need to have a pretty strong, you know, he has a strong conviction in the value of those nodes. Interesting.
That's right. I mean, that's what it takes to be, you know, be a market participant, a trader, because we're doing that in our storage activities. We're doing that when we write multi-year retail contract. We're doing that when we trade speculatively on ICE. It's really a core function of the business across the different business lines.
It's different to say an optimizer that signs a 12-month contract and says, I'm going to make you as much money as you can make in the market. Ultimately, if it's a revenue share, then of course their revenue goes down if the market goes down. And that's actually a tricky thing for, you know, optimizers forecasting cash flow is quite a tricky problem in itself. But if you're going to sign long-term tolling agreements, then you have so much reliance on your medium and long-term view of those notes. Fascinating.
Absolutely.
Okay, so following on your point there about analyzing TB2s and nodes, when you think about the value of optimization, when you're selling optimization, or when you're analyzing the market to figure out what's the true alpha, how do you do that? And what did you find?
We use the same TB baselines to evaluate kind of optimization performance relative to the opportunity for revenue at a specific location. We call this TB2 uplift in case of a 2-hour battery. And so it's just the achieved revenue divided by this TB2 baseline that we create looking at the node. And so we can then rank batteries by their TB2 uplift to account for the comparison between optimization performance of different batteries normalized by the location. Again, it's not perfect. You really can only compare batteries of similar durations. So we could do a TB1 comparison or a TB2 comparison, but not between the two. But regardless, you know, if we just compare all the 2-hour batteries, we saw that in 2024, some of them made a less than half of the value of their TB2 baseline. What was the opportunity at their location? And some of them made, you know, 30% or more above that TB2 baseline. And so the spread between the bottom to the top in terms of the TB2 uplift is a little over 2.5x in terms of revenue, which coincidentally was very similar to what we saw in terms of just the TB2 spread of locational differences. And that tells us that, you know, there's really big spreads between locations on the grid for batteries and also for optimization conditional on location. And it means, you know, if you want to operate a battery, you need to do multiple things really well. You can't just focus on siting or just on optimization, because they're both so important that to be good, you need to be really good at both of them.
And then where does Gridmatic start and finish? So if I'm an asset owner and I want to sign a contract with Gridmatic to optimize my battery, do you assume that you can control my battery via API? And do you assume that my battery is going to give you a certain quality of data? Or are you willing to take a bet on less capable systems? Or do you put hardware onto sites? You know, what's your approach on integrating with battery assets? How do you do that? It can be a nightmare, right? This is why I'm saying it. It can be an absolute nightmare. And this can be, for an optimizer, the integration part and getting quality data from assets could end up being kind of a third to half of the OPEX of the business, just with all these different types of assets. So as a business, how is Gridmatic thinking about that problem?
So we're a queasy in ERCOT, a scheduling entity. As a result, we need to connect to the battery and have a SCADA connection to the physical plant that follows the standards and requirements laid out by the market operator. And so that part of it, you know, it can be a challenge, but everyone sort of somewhat knows the rules. And so, you know, the battery operators need to be providing telemetry data that meets the requirements of the market. And that's actually sufficient for us to operate a battery. We don't need additional connections to site beyond that necessarily, because we're not necessarily controlling the battery directly. We're submitting bids to the market operator, and the market operator is then submitting controls to the battery. Now, we do often try to get more telemetry and control to the site. And that's because there are additional data points that provide value beyond what the grid operator requires. These are things related to battery health, cell balancing, these types of issues. And if we get additional telemetry for those points, we can also, you know, potentially conduct activities that maintain battery health in a way that's better for the system. And that can be a win-win for us and for the battery owner.
You guys should do an integration or integrations with some of the battery analytics companies, some incredible companies out there doing cell health work. And if that's of real value to your system, then perhaps you guys could get integration with them.
Absolutely. No, we're following that space closely. I think we're a prime candidate to be a user of those services.
David, I've got to ask you about this fund because it is very unique and I've got lots of technical questions about it. I'll see where we get with it. So how does it work? So you've got a 50, not as well as being an optimizer, you've also got a $50 million storage fund or an optimization underwriting fund, or I think you call it a storage fund, right? So how does that, whose money is that? And what does a fund do? Can you talk us through that?
Sure. Effectively, the fund serves as a credit facility. So we have outside limited partners. We're also one of the limited partners in the fund. So we've put up some of our money, and that money goes to collateralizing the offtake contracts with counterparties. So we're not investment grade counterparty. And so when an investor, a debt provider, for instance, to a project looks at the offtake contract with someone like us, they need some assurance that that contract is going to be worth something. And there's typical ways to handle this are posting collateral. The owners is typically also posting collateral to us to make sure that they're delivering the project. And so that requires capital. So we use that capital to post the collateral to sign a contract. And then, you know, we try to make money from the operations of the battery. And the money that we make from there serves as a return to the investors based on the collateral that they posted up front.
So when did you guys get the idea to do this? Because this is one of the big problems with off-takers, especially if you want to be a startup in this space. Even if you have the best product, sometimes the best product doesn't always win because it's about balance sheet strength. But Gridmatic has gone sort of round the back door to provide balance sheet strength through this fund, which is really interesting. So when did you get the idea? And then how long did it take you to raise this fund?
Yeah, well, so this is our second fund. Our first fund focuses on the financial trading, not backed by assets. That fund launched in 2021. So we had raised it before that. Then the second fund we launched at the beginning of 2023. So we had the idea, you know, really from near the beginning of our battery businesses, this was a potential option for how we would, you know, go to market as a provider and optimizer of batteries that wanted to, you know, use our trading capability to have more skin in the game, but not looking at, you know, it being an asset owner ourselves.
So what does 50 million get you? How many megawatt hours can you back with $50 million?
It's sort of a complicated formula because it depends on lengths of contracts and kind of size of systems. But the rough order of magnitude is something like 500 megawatts of batteries that could be backed.
Say Gridmatic 10Xs, hopefully more, but let's say 10Xs from here. So to back that, to do a 10 gig portfolio, you really need like $1 billion really to underwrite that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's where we want to get to next.
So as well as being an optimization business, you end up being a capital custodian, a fund management business. How are you set up to do that? What does the organization look like for that? Is it totally separate, arm's length, or is it within? There must be all sorts of regulations and rules about this. How does that work?
Yeah, so we operate two commodities trading funds that are regulated by the CFTC. So we have our finance organization that has folks who know much more about that regulatory regime than I do and have to maintain the books accordingly. But I think that is, you know, that's the reality that energy is a capital intensive business. And we think that, you know, providing the most value that's needed does require us putting up capital and absorbing the risk from owners that you know, that's their model is to share that risk with counterparties.
It's absolutely fascinating. I'm sure that some of our European listeners will be thinking, when's the next optimizer in Europe gonna come up with a fund? Watch this space. So now here's your opportunity to plug something. Is there anything you want to talk about to our listeners about Gridmatic or some news or an announcement? And then we're going to get to my favorite question, which is about your contrarian view. But first, any news to share?
I think just quite simply, you know, we're in the market as a service provider, an off-taker for tolls, for physical revenue floors, for the US ISOs for batteries. And so if you're a battery owner interested in these services, please reach out to us. We're happy to talk.
Okay. And now to your contrarian view, David. What do you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
I think the landscape of storage IPPs or independent power producers, today it looks a lot like the renewable IPP landscape, but in the future, it will look much more like the gas IPP business. On its own, that might not be a remarkable statement, but I think some of the impacts of that view, I think, would be considered contrarian relative to how we've seen the storage IPP businesses develop to date. The reason for that is, so wind and solar, they're really all about front-loaded value. The economic decisions that matter the most happen before the project is built. It's things like siting and procurement and offtake contracting. But then once the project's up and running, there's not that much active ongoing management. Whereas battery storage and gas are really operationally intensive, a lot of the value is created after the project starts operating. It means that these projects require constant active management to succeed. And this difference, this fundamental difference, has a big impact on who owns and operates these assets. In the US, wind and solar ownership is fairly fragmented, but when the top five wind IPPs own about 30% of all the wind market, and solar, it's a bit lower. And beyond those, a lot of the owners are financial firms and they outsource the operations. Whereas with gas, it's a totally different story. If you exclude the regulated utilities and you just look at gas IPPs, the top five gas IPPs own 70% of the installed capacity of gas plants. And part of that is gas has been around longer, but a big part is that in gas, the operational performance really matters. And the best operators thrive and the non-specialists over time have struggled. And their customer relationships look really different too. We have large corporations sign a lot of long-term renewable PPAs, but they don't sign PPAs with gas IPPs. You know, gas is working with load-serving entities, not corporates. And so I think, you know, the large gas IPPs, they're not just generating companies. They also operate retail businesses in competitive markets, and they use their gas as a risk management tool for their own load books and for a little bit of spec trading. And so right now, for the most part, we don't see that with battery storage IPPs. Battery storage looks like wind and solar. A lot of the IPPs have come from the wind and solar world and they're focused on project development, siting, and procurement. But because the storage requires this active management, I think over time we'll see storage IPPs evolve to look more like gas IPPs. And so there'll be consolidation where the best storage operators will benefit, and the business models that they have will become more intertwined with trading and retail operations. And so I think, you know, the current storage IPP landscape won't sort of grow and expand consistently the way it has, but instead will look quite different in 10 years from the way it looks today.
But what about the ownership structure? So in the gas world, you have a lot more vertical integration. And so do you expect that to happen in our world, in storage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really the load serving entities that are the ultimate users for these balancing services, whether it's from gas and storage. And so in the gas world, what that means is you have utilities that own a bunch of gas, and you have gas IPPs that then hedge their fleets with a retail book. I think the same thing is going to happen with storage, where there'll be a lot of storage that's owned by utilities, load serving entities, and then the large storage IPPs will also be thinking about storage primarily as a hedge for a portfolio of operations rather than as a dedicated kind of merchant operation.
One of the things I've noticed in the last few years is that the asset management part of operating, there's been a lot of wind and solar asset managers who have turned their hand to storage. And some of the things are the same, you know, going to, you know, be on site, managing safety, site access, permit to work, repairing inverters, that kind of stuff is the same. But there's this massive chunk of it, which is so commercial and market driven, which they have to upskill so much. There's been very few of the wind and solar asset management companies who have managed to make that really work. And I think it's because, as you say, it's the complexity element. So how does Gridmatic fit within that new paradigm then? How do you think about, this is really interesting, how do you think about an optimizer fitting within that world that looks more gassy?
Yeah, I think there's basically two directions for optimizers to go in. One option is to kind of sell software, it is a SaaS model, to regulated utilities or other storage owners that aren't so highly motivated to care about revenue performance. And I think that's a real business for storage optimizers. But the other option is to really align very closely with customers, because you have to understand that the good ones are going to get big, and focus on commercial constructs that align the incentives really strongly. Things like, you know, pay for performance only service contracts or offtake structures that share in the rewards. And we've really chosen that second path. I think some optimizers are still kind of trying to serve all the markets. I think that will be a challenge in the long term as consolidation occurs.
Has Gridmatic got any plans beyond the US?
Well, not today, but certainly all power markets worldwide are of interest to us. It's certainly an area that we're interested in, but our active growth today, we still see a lot of opportunity for expansion in the US.
All right. Well, David, that was fascinating. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. Our listeners no doubt will really like this episode. It's always great when we get optimizers on, because being that close to the market, you have to think in a very entrepreneurial way, which is always fascinating. So thanks for taking the time to speak to us. Good luck. Really excited to see what comes next from Gridmatic, and speak soon.
Thanks so much. Good to chat.